This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, March 4, 2008. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Pakistan's government moves to shut down Afghan refugee camps. And Obama tries to seal his lead while Clinton struggles to stay in the race. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. Regional tensions have escalated in South America in the aftermath of a Colombian military raid that killed a FARC senior commander inside of Ecuadorian national territory. Martin Markovitz has more from Caracas.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez ordered 10 battalions to the Colombian border after Colombian President Alvaro Uribe said his government would ask the International Criminal Court to try Chavez for financing and supporting Colombia's main rebel group, the FARC. The Uribe government says documents found in the laptop of slain FARC commander Rafael Reyes indicate that Chavez paid $300 million to the FARC. The Colombian government is investigating whether the alleged payoff was in exchange for hostages the FARC released to Venezuelan authorities last week. The Colombian government also claims to have found evidence that the FARC was trying to purchase uranium. Venezuela has denied helping the Marxist guerrilla group. President Chavez says hostage negotiations have been aimed at working towards a peaceful solution to the armed conflict that has raged in Colombia for more than four decades. The Colombian military raid of a FARC camp within Ecuador has provoked a regional diplomatic crisis. The raid killed the FARC's number two leader and their main diplomat. Both Ecuador and Venezuela have recalled their ambassadors from Bogota and mobilized troops to their borders with Colombia. The Organization of American States called for an emergency session today to mediate the conflict before it escalates. Reading for Martin Markovitz in Venezuela, I'm Eric Klein for Free Speech Radio News.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is on a tour of the Middle East, ostensibly to restart peace negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. Ghassan Banoura reports.
Secretary Rice met with Egyptian, Palestinian, and Israeli leaders today in the context of the U.S.-brokered peace talks. The Palestinian-Israeli peace talks have been advancing very slowly without concrete results since they were first revived at a summit in Annapolis last November. Secretary Rice speaking today in Ramallah.
We look forward to the resumption of those negotiations. Hamas in its activities, including launching of rocket attacks against Israeli citizens, has created conditions that have made it very difficult.
Rice made no mention of the recent five-day siege on Gaza that killed 120 Palestinians and injured 300 others, other than to regret civilian casualties and repeat that Israel has the right to defend itself. The Israeli military withdrew their ground troops from Gaza just yesterday. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas suspended talks with Israel on Sunday over the military strike on Gaza. Although Abbas has agreed to resume negotiations, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert says Israel will continue to carry out airstrikes against Gaza in order to stop homemade rocket fire. Homemade rocket fire has killed 13 Israelis total since 2001. The Israeli military has killed more than 120 Gazans in the past 6 days. For FSRN and IMEMC.org, this is Ghassan Banoura in Palestine.
California Supreme Court today took up the issue of same-sex marriage. The case combines three class-action lawsuits from same-sex couples and the city of San Francisco, which had moved to permit gay marriage in 2004. The California Supreme Court has 3 months to rule on the case. Thousands of workers across Germany walked off the job today in a second round of public sector strikes. Cinnamon Nippard has more from Berlin.
Hospital services, public transportation, and garbage collection were disrupted today in 12 out of Germany's 16 states. One of Germany's biggest trade unions, Verdi, is calling for an 8% wage increase or at least 200 euros more per month, whichever is higher, for an estimated 1.3 million employees. The union says that wages in the public sector have either stagnated or dropped in recent years. The government has offered a 5% wage increase over 24 months and an increase in working hours from 39 to 40 per week. But unions say a 5% increase is not enough. The negotiations will continue on Thursday. Cinnamon Nippard reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Berlin.
Prince William County, Virginia, has started enforcing some of the harshest immigration measures in the country. Local police are now required to investigate the immigration status of every suspected offender if the officer has reason to believe the suspect may be undocumented. Investigation of a suspect's immigration status will fall to the police department's newly created Criminal Alien Unit. The program will cost Prince William County taxpayers $6.5 million this year. Those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
Four states head to the polls. Voters in Ohio, Texas, Vermont, and Rhode Island vote or caucus today, and in the case of Texas, they vote and caucus. Republican John McCain hopes to seal the nomination while the Democratic race continues to unfold. More than 400 delegates are at stake for the Democrats, and the campaigning has become fierce in recent days. Ohio and Texas are crucial states to both candidates. Barack Obama hopes for wins to further his lead, while Hillary Clinton hopes to win in order to justify a reason to stay in the race. And as the candidates are jockeying for votes, Ohio has undergone a drastic change in their election system, change that's meant to restore credibility in the state's elections. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports from Ohio.
All eyes will be on Ohio as voters head to the polls. Pictures of long lines, people being turned away, and discrepancies in results are all images of 2004. Reports have concluded that many of Ohio's problems could be blamed in part to then-Secretary of State Kenneth Blackwell. He also served as the George Bush Ohio re-election co-chair. The new Secretary of State, Jennifer Bruner, was elected in 2007 on a message of transparent and accessible elections. Today is her first real test.
The one thing I can say about Ohio's election officials is that they understand that no matter what, an election has to happen, and they are very experienced at dealing with quick changes in environment. They can turn on a dime, and we've done some things such as essentially a lot of things that are not really glitzy, but are very important infrastructure building for a good, solid election system.
Bruner has made a whole host of changes that she says offer more checks and balances to the system, including implementing new ways the ballots are counted, conducting enhanced poll worker training, providing paper ballots to people who request them, and a switching out of electronic voting machines for paper ballots in some parts of the state. Michelle Lawrence Jawando, National Campaign Manager for Election Protection for People for the American Way, is working in Ohio to ensure full and easy access to the polls. She says she's not happy with every election-related decision Bruner has made, but she says the time does seem to have turned since 2004.
Secretary of State has made courageous moves in what she's been able to do. She's moving in the right direction. We couldn't have asked for a better situation in terms of someone who's even open to hear the needs of the community and what are some of our concerns. So we are applauding her in some of those steps. And, you know, our role as advocates is to make sure that we get it right. And we recognize it's never going to be 100% perfect, but we want to make sure that that voice is there.
Cuyahoga County has more than 1 million registered voters. It encompasses Cleveland, it's heavily Democratic, and has a large African-American population. This is where many of Ohio's voting problems happened. In an effort to minimize irregularities, Secretary of State Bruner implemented paper ballots here. Many, though not all, were pleased with this move.
It's just plain, you know, plain and simple. This is what it should have been a long time ago, because that technology kind of bams me, and I'm a senior, okay?
Annie Gaines, a resident of East Cleveland, said the same thing many did at the polls this morning.
Yeah, I'm skeptical about it because everything, to me, always be banished or something. It'd be always something wrong with it every time. Look at here in Ohio, how we messed up years ago, you know, and it just, to me, is a better thing what it is today, paperback.
As of airtime, election protection volunteers have reported minor issues, but no systematic problems. Early voting and absentee votes have been going on in Ohio for about a month, with high numbers. It's expected that up to one quarter of the people voted early. As for day-of voting, bad weather could reduce turnout, but early tallies reveal records could be broken. For Free Speech Radio News in Cuyahoga County, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Daily demonstrations against Kosovo's declaration of independence continue on the Serbian side of the divided city of Mitrovica. Serbian members of the police force, one of the few ethnically integrated institutions in Kosovo, have turned in their badges, refusing to work under the new authorities. Amy Miller reports from Mitrovica on the minorities' fears for their future and security.
Mitrovica, or Kosovska Mitrovica, as it is called on the Serbian side, is a small city divided by the Ibar River, which has seen its economy destroyed since the closure of the Trepša mine in 1999.
Oy, Kosovo, Kosovo, zemljo moja.
Mitrovica Serbs, approximately 30% of the population, continue to reject independence for Kosovo. Traditional Serb songs declaring undying love for Kosovo are a regular feature at daily demonstrations pledging allegiance to Serbia. On the other side of the Ibar, for the Albanian community, life continues as before the declaration, without any demonstrations in hopes of keeping their side of the town calm and stable. Miloš Milotović is a restaurant worker from Kosovska Mitrovica.
The situation nowadays is not safe. In the night there's a lot of shooting. You cannot sleep. It's a really critical time. The army is constantly around you and you're suspicious all the time. You're not safe in your own surroundings because there's the army around and there's more to it.
The army that Milutović is suspicious of is NATO's Kosovo Stabilization Force, or KFOR, working in conjunction with the UN. Mitrovica Serbs place little faith in NATO protection. Many cite a 2004 incident when the drowning of an Albanian child led to weeks of arson, murder, and bombings by the Albanian majority against their neighbors. Later investigation found that the drowning was an accident that never involved any Serbs. Mitrovica Serbs bitterly remember having to defend themselves as KFOR did little to prevent the attacks. The two sides of the city have had little interaction since then. Milan Stepanović is certain there will be more violence in the town he has grown up in.
This is just the calm before the storm. The Albanians have calmed down just so their independence could be recognized, but it's just a matter of time. Just like 4 years ago, another month or two, and the new conflict will occur. I think the Albanians are going to chase away people from central Kosovo. Every year, it's springtime. It's become annual already. Here are some provocations. Now we see that the Albanian government fired every Serbian police officer, and we can only speculate, but from previous experience, we can expect new attacks.
Most Serbian police officers across Kosovo have been suspended. They walked off the job last Friday, refusing to work under the command of the new European mission, which will oversee the Kosovo Police Service. For the Serbians, to accept the new EU command is also to recognize the new state of Kosovo. The remaining Serbian police officers across Kosovo are expected to leave their posts and join in the boycott. The police force has been one of the few integrated institutions in Kosovo. The dispute leaves Serbs with little or no representation in the new state's functioning. While the EU representative was reported as saying the European Union's mission began to take over the institutional responsibilities, including policing last week, the spokesperson for the UN mission in Kosovo, Alexander Ivanko, has stated the opposite.
Right now, we are not in a transition phase as far as the UN is concerned. What we are doing is, first of all, together with KFOR, we're trying to ensure a safe and secure environment.
Negotiations over jurisdiction over the police force in Kosovska Mitrovica continue today. But with no sign of agreement between the two sides, Serbian citizens have promised to continue their daily demonstrations against the sovereign Kosovo. Mitrovica is expected to be a divided city for many years to come. Reporting for FSRN, this is Amy Miller.
For archives of this or any other newscast or documentary, you can visit our website at fsrn.org. You can also email us at comments@fsrn.org. That's comments@fsrn.org. $2.3 million people are behind bars in the United States, the highest incarceration rate in the world. A recent report by the Pew Center indicates that the U.S. leads in percentage, growth, and absolute number of prisoners worldwide. FSRN's Naji Mujahid takes a look at the conditions that prisoners face in the prison capital of the world.
The prison population in the United States has exploded by 600% over the past 30 years. It should be noted that though the prison population has skyrocketed, the level of violent crime has been steady. The current rate of incarceration can be attributed to, among other things, the so-called war on drugs, which imposes harsh penalties for nonviolent drug offenses, and according to the Drug Policy Alliance, though blacks and whites are arrested for drugs at about the same rate, blacks are more likely to be prosecuted, more likely to be convicted, and more likely to receive a harsher sentence. This would explain why in places like Washington, D.C., the black-white incarceration ratio is 20 to 1. And in fact, according to the Sentencing Project, statistics nationwide show that black males have a 1 in 3 chance of serving time at some point in their lives. They can't build prisons fast enough to keep up with the harsh sentences handed out, and conditions in overcrowded and underfunded prisons across the U.S. draw criticism from all sides. Members of the American Federation of Government Employees and Bureau of Prison Officials, including correctional officers, say it's virtually impossible to run a safe and secure prison today.
Homicide rates are up in our prisons. Assaults on staff with weapons are up in our prisons. Assaults on staff, period. Great number of riots are occurring in our prisons. We're having disturbances at the greatest rate. We've had more shots fired from towers in the last year than any time in the history of the Bureau. And it's not due to inmates trying to escape. It's them trying to murder other inmates and murder our staff. And I say, Mr. Attorney General, we're not taking it anymore.
Correctional officers from all over the country last month staged a protest in front of the Department of Justice to demand more funding for the Bureau of Prisons. But the view from the other side of the bar suggests funding might not be the root of the problem. I spoke with a man who asked to remain anonymous about his experiences during 13 years of incarceration at various prisons in the state of Maryland.
Most of the guys that are in there, they don't want any problem. If the officers just handle things differently and be a lot more professional, things wouldn't even escalate a lot of time.
He talked about the things that correctional officers did that contributed to the chaos behind the walls, like how they smuggled contraband like food, cigarettes, cell phones, pornography, drugs, and weapons, including guns, into the prison. He also talked about how disrespectful they were in their speech and interaction towards the prisoners, and particularly the use of unnecessary force.
Like one guy, he had a cell phone. They almost beat the guy to death because he had a cell phone. I mean, take the cell phone. Why you gotta beat him? But a lot of them have the messed up mentality. It's their job to punish you. Their job is to watch you and make sure you don't commit any more crime and make sure you don't escape. But they take it upon themselves to try to punish you.
He believes that the prisons would run a lot better if guards were more respectful and humane and less antagonistic and violent towards inmates. But some unruly guards isn't the only problem that the prisoners have. They also experience limited health care, sexual assaults by guards and other prisoners, a lack of educational programs and books, and ever-increasing use of special housing units, in which prisoners are deprived of human contact and held in total darkness or underneath bright lights for 23 hours a day, sometimes more, among other abuses. Sometimes called control units, segregation units, or isolation units, these types of units are usually used as a punishment or ostensibly for the inmate's safety, such as in the case of a snitch or a juvenile in an adult prison or someone with mental health problems. Carol Sharoff of Human Rights Watch.
This is where you see the most egregious violation. Just the sheer deprivation of human contact is, you know, has such a psychological and physical impact on people. You know, people aren't meant to live that way. Dostoevsky once said, if you want to understand a society, you should look inside its prisons. And, you know, that issue of the special control units and all of these violations and abuses really show that, you know, is this the kind of society we want to be? It's deeply, deeply disturbing.
It is for this reason that many groups have made it their mission to fight against these injustices. One such group, Critical Resistance, takes the position that the prison system should be abolished altogether. Pilar Maskey, Membership and Leader Development Coordinator for Critical Resistance.
Basically, we believe that if there was better, good education system, if there was housing for everyone, if there was food for everyone, if people weren't struggling and trying to survive every day to just make the daily necessities for our families, that we would be living in a freer world and we wouldn't need to rely on prisons and police to handle our problems.
Prison abolition may seem a bit utopian and far-fetched, but so did the abolition of slavery at one time. In fact, the parallels between slavery and the coerced labor now prevalent in U.S. prisons has been expounded upon by many activists and academics. The 13th Amendment, which seemingly abolished slavery, included an exception for individuals duly convicted of a crime. Reporting for FSRN from Washington, D.C., I'm Najee Mujahid of the D.C. Radio Co-op.
Pakistan's government wants to shut down more Afghan refugee camps this year and send the refugees home. Pakistan's Commissioner of Afghan Refugees said his organization is working on realistic plans. Some 2 million Afghans, about 8% of Afghanistan's pre-war population, still lives in Pakistan. Zach Badarf reports from Peshawar.
Kachigari, or Rough Town in English, is located on a main road on the outskirts of Peshawar. Today, signs posted on the property say, "Don't enter Pakistani military property." The shells of hundreds of mud huts still remain, but bulldozers are leveling them, under the supervision of Pakistani troops. The camp's land is prime real estate in this bustling border town just 30 miles from the Afghan border. After it was closed last year, the UN reports 40,000 of its 60,000 occupants returned to Afghanistan. Since 2002, the UN Refugee Agency says more than 3.4 million Afghan refugees have gone back home. But the UN doesn't expect most of the remaining 1.1 million Afghans still living in Pakistan's 85 refugee camps to head to their homeland. At least, not for now. About 80% polled by the UN say in the near future they don't want to go back. Most cited security as their biggest concern. But like butcher Abdul Latif, most Afghans here don't have land to return to. This 65-year-old Afghan walked several miles just to come see his former home of 30 years.
I wouldn't mind going back to my motherland, but it's too difficult right now. We have no lands and no skills to earn money to support our families. It is very difficult. The whole of Afghanistan is destroyed and there are no jobs. Then there is the issue of security. We can survive in harsh winters and hot summers, but not in war. So when the people have no jobs, no food, and no peace, how can they live there?
But the country director of the International Medical Corps in Pakistan says most refugees believe life is better in Pakistan. Jehangir Ali Khan says at the very least the Afghans can get education and health care here. But Khan says shutting down camps displaces refugees yet again.
You see, these camps are established for quite some time in these areas, and they have a better living in these places. Now, if they are relocated, probably they will have to live in the tents once again, or they will have to rebuild their houses or blah, blah, blah in those areas. And again, there is a problem that proper facilities would not be available there.
Fakir Hassan pushes a wooden cart with a container of Afghan sweet rice past the remains of his former home of 30 years. He sells a bowl of rice for 5 rupees and earns about $1.50 a day. He's one of about 400,000 Afghans working in Pakistan. The UN's Vivian Tan said food supplies were cut by the World Food Program in the mid-90s to encourage self-reliance. But nearly 80% of the registered Afghans are women, children, and the elderly. Since the army kicked out Hassan's family from the camp, he's rented a house.
When I pay my rent, then I can't provide food. When I buy food, then it's tough to pay the rent. I want to leave Pakistan, but it seems impossible because of my limited income.
The government also evicted 12-year-old Saif Ullah from Kachigari, where he lived from birth. Residing nearby in an unofficial refugee camp, he now walks past his childhood home on his way to school. Saif's father had a vegetable shop in the camp, but like their house, it was also destroyed. They were promised a tent and money to build a new home, but received nothing.
I have very fond memories of this old camp, and so it hurt me when the Pakistani army destroyed my house. They told us, "Go to your own country. This is not your country." Pakistanis degrade us by calling us refugees, and it really bothers me. Inshallah, one day we will go to our own land, and we will no longer be refugees.
The Pakistan government has said the 2 million plus refugees can stay until the end of 2009. After that, their future is uncertain. The UN is still negotiating with Pakistani officials, but a spokesperson told FSRN it's up to the government to ultimately decide what to do with a population on its soil. The next meeting of UN, Pakistani, and Afghan officials is scheduled for March. In Peshawar, Pakistan, I'm Zach Badorf with Mudassir Shah for Free Speech Radio News.
And now, from his cell on Pennsylvania's death row, a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Prison House of Nations. With the release of the Pew Center on the States report comes news that proves without question that the U.S. is the world's champion when it comes to incarceration rates. Of 100 Americans, there is one adult in prison. According to news reports detailing the Pew Center research, the year 2008 began with 2,319,258 people in U.S. jails and prisons. No other nation can boast such a raw number or per capita rate of incarceration. Not China, which has over four times U.S. population, nor India, which has three times the population. That's because the U.S. transformed its prisons into a job-making program and a business. The 50 states have spent over $49 billion on its 2007 prisons budget, up from $11 billion spent in the 1987 prisons budget. Over a decade ago, I warned of precisely this outcome in my book, Live from Death Row. That's because we were then in the midst of the incarceration boom due to tougher and tougher sentencing. The so-called drug war has fed this binge. And only now, over a decade after the rash and harsh imprisonment of many, many people, the Sentencing Commission is easing the rules on sentencing for possession of crack cocaine versus powder. Why would the government ease up? It may be because the states are drowning in red ink over burgeoning prison costs. Because decades after the onset of the drug war, in 2005, over 33.6 million Americans over 12 years old used cocaine. As for crack, some 8 million people reported usage of that drug in their lifetime. If we look at U.S. high school seniors, we find an astonishing figure. In 1975, 1.9% of these students reported cocaine use. In 2006, that number was 2.5%. So much for the so-called drug war. For these figures show how, after billions of dollars were spent on prisons, and an incredible number of people were imprisoned in rates that no other nation has yet faced, the rate of drug use has not only not declined, it has increased. Guess who's winning? From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Free Speech Radio News is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. To find out how you can support FSRN's programming, visit our website at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. Our producers are Monica Lopez and Tina Gysi. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. DC editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado.